Well, you put things inside apples and blow my fucking mind.
Welcome to Geeks Without God with Tim Wick, Nick Glover, and Molly Glover.
We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God. We don't recognize moral authority. We don't accept divine superiority. We're geeks, geeks without God.
This week on Geeks Without God, we're joined by our friend William Bradshaw to talk about the Netflix movie In and of Itself. It's kind of weird how you can spoil this movie, but we might spoil it, so just go watch
it. We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God.
Welcome to Geeks Without God. I'm your host, Tim Wick. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Nick Glover.
Hey!
And Molly Glover.
Hello!
Hi, and today we are joined by a very special guest, our friend Will Bradshaw. He is an archivist for David Copperfield, instructor at McBride's Magic and Mystery School, and believe it or not, a magician. And he's the perfect kind of person to talk about what we're going to talk about today, which is the movie In and of Itself, currently viewable on Hulu. So before we get into... Hi, Will. Thanks for being here.
Hey, it's my pleasure. I was going to let Tim finish, you know, his question there. I was deeply compelled by it. I was on the edge of my seat.
I was being very interesting.
I couldn't help it. I worried people would think we were making you up.
I mean, you're not completely wrong. I'm just an illusion.
Well, indeed. This movie is all about illusions, so... Will felt like the right person.
By the way, for those of you who are playing at home, every time that we say illusion, take a drink. And,
oh, no.
Which also, we should be mentioning Jeremy Stomberg a lot. So we're going to get people super drunk today. Okay. So In and of Itself is an original film on, it's called a documentary because it is a filmed theatrical experience. I think that's why they call it a documentary on Hulu right now. So if you are streaming on Hulu, it is something that you can go view. It is directed by Frank Oz, who also directed the stage play featuring Derek Delgadio, who is a magician, although the play slash movie is certainly about more than magic. He's using magic to tell a story.
It's definitely like solo performance for sure, right?
I think from what I've read about interviews and stuff with him, he tends to eschew the term magician a little bit. And I don't know how much of an affectation that is or if it's like simplistic for what he does as performance art, kind of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to go into I want to start with you, Will, as being the expert of the four of us on some of the things going on there. Kind of get your take on it. What did you think?
I watched it and I thought it was fantastic. Mm-hmm. It hit all the right chords for me as an entertainer. Because, I mean, I originally went to theater school. And so being able to go and see a piece of magic where, you know, there was heart and soul and a story being portrayed and questions being asked. Because ultimately, I mean, what it comes down to is asking, what is the concept of identity?
Yeah.
And everything about this, you know, piece of theater is talking about what is identity. And the magic is a medium to these questions as opposed to the entire point of the performance, which happens very often in magical performances. It only is about, you know, the piece of magic, the impossibility of it, and then that's as far as it goes, which can be a great thing on its own. But, you know, with the current amount of how often that happens in the magic world, having something new and fresh and provocative was fantastic. I enjoyed it a lot. You know, I teared up near the end on the penultimate piece of magic. I won't ruin exactly what's happening there, but, you know, when he was walking in amongst the audience, for those of you who saw it, you know, and having that moment, it was like, ah, yes. So it was, I loved it.
Tim?
Yeah, I should point out before you say anything, Molly, we are going to spoil the shit out of this, as we do with many of these things. So if you haven't seen it yet, and this more than many of the other experiences that we talk about, I'm going to say, if you have any interest in watching this movie, you don't want to listen to this podcast until you go watch it. So Will did very well there, not spoiling anything, but there will be spoilers, no doubt. So as we go forward, just keep that in mind. If you're interested in watching this movie, and you should be, we're going to spoil the shit out of it. Now, Molly, go ahead.
Tim, I was going to say, do you mind if I ask a quick question from the first piece of magic, if that's all right? Not about it, but is that, I want to ask Will something just to start off. Is that all right? Okay. So Will, I am curious if at first, when I was watching it, I was like, oh, I think I understand what this is going to be. He's going to do tricks or illusions. He's going to do sleight of hand and close-up magic. And then there's going to be like a vague story around it, like there is for most magic shows. And that very first illusion, I really thought, felt that way with the bottle and the ship, the paper ship. Right. And then I guess for me, it was when he started doing card tricks, card manipulation, that I was like, oh, this is something else. What point for you did you realize this was more than just the average, or not even the average, but more than what you usually see in the magic world?
Well, I mean, for me, the moment for me when it came in and I'm like, this is not your standard magic show, is actually his opening when he is talking about being the ruletista.
Yeah.
And that really comes more from a lot of experience watching magic shows and being around magicians. There's an idea in a lot of magic shows where you start off with the big flashy production and you hook them in and you get them directly into the entertainment, because it's, I was just recently talking with another a theater friend of mine, and we were talking about the difference between a piece of theater, what you watch, and a movie. And a movie kind of gets you in, and it's entertaining and bam, 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 and it's fantastic and fun to watch. But a piece of theater is provocative. It makes you think and feel in ways that you normally don't. And so when he took the extra amount of time at the beginning to set the scenes for kind of a piece of theater, as opposed to flashy production magic, whatever it is, or appearing, you know, with a flash of light, which sometimes happens, or any number of ways, by starting off a little bit slower, it sets the scene for this as a piece of theater, as opposed to a piece of magic primarily.
Interesting. That's really cool.
We started with a spoiler warning, but I feel like I have a mixed opinion on that, because like, I feel like experiencing this, even if you kind of knew it was going to happen, might still have the level of emotional impact that this had, because it's not just about the illusions and the sleight of hand and that sort of thing. It really is all about the momentum and the pace and the atmosphere,
the emotion
that comes along with it, that's in this presentation and in the audience's faces as they're kind of experiencing this live. I don't know how much spoilers would ruin this for me, or how much they would lessen that emotional impact, because like, I was legit crying at a few points, and I don't know that, like, you could have told me that ahead of time, and I still think it would have happened, which isn't always the case with stuff like this.
Yeah, I think for me, it's more the thing that you can spoil is the nature of the illusions, because often I think with magic, when it's most effective is when it surprises you, when you're like, I know what this trick is, I know where this trick is going, and then it takes you in a different direction and you're like, oh, well, that's not what I expected at all. And even if you have some knowledge of the working of how magic works, how illusions work, how sleight of hand works, how any of these tricks work, when it takes you in a different direction, I think that's compelling and interesting. And so there were several times where this show either brings out an illusion at a point you weren't expecting there to be one, or takes the illusion in a direction that you weren't expecting, which I think is the one reason that I'm like, there could be spoilers if you don't want to know where those are going. One thing that I was told by Nick and Molly before I watched it, they had watched it before me, was they were like, this is a no phone movie.
Yeah,
you can't be like
get it away from you
and mucking on your phone with some game or something. It's like you have to be involved in watching and experiencing it, because if you look away, it's very easy to miss something.
I would even say if you are distracted from the momentum, you won't experience the same emotional. I can't imagine seeing this in the theater. Like, and I think that to me, a big part of it, I was thinking about how incredible that would feel, because you think of the tension you feel when you're part of an audience and you're involved in something, like even whether it's when something goes wrong and you all have that moment of, oh my God, that something just went wrong and we were all here for it. Right. Or like the, or it's so dramatically perfectly acted that you're like, you feel the chills of the rest of the audience. And this had such emotional impact even through the camera. I think that even just like, there may be things you didn't miss. Like you could be on your phone during the Rulatista speech and it's not that you would miss anything that with your eyes, but I think you're just missing the impact of his gaze. He's got a very intense gaze.
You're missing the immersion of the experience, really.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
There's vulnerability there too. Like he does in later, you know, one of the later chambers, if you will, of the show, the story about him and his mom, like, yeah. Super hit home for me. My mom came out when I was 13 and we were living in a small town outside of, you know, Minneapolis by a couple of tiers. And we moved into the city to be, you know, a little bit more accepted, a little bit, more diverse in those ways. And so like, that was a vulnerable story for him to tell. And there are other times he told stories about himself, like the beginning with the Rulatista story, or the card,
Dog and the Wolf.
The Dog and the Wolf. He talks about, you know, Wolf, the guy that's teaching him these sleight of hand. But like, that was the one where he got really vulnerable, which I think makes it easier for you, the watcher, to become open and vulnerable as well.
Well, and a big part of, I mean, what makes theater as well, and this is part of, you know, I went to school and I was classically trained as an actor. You know, we talk about, you know, what makes good theater work is honesty of emotion in constrained circumstances. So what happens is, you know, you're put into the play, you have the lines, you go along with these lines because that is the vision, but you need to have an emotional honesty as an actor for that. And that's one of the reasons why I would say that, at least my thought of one of the reasons why he kind of shies away from the term magician and goes for something a little bit further, because a lot of the times, you know, yet again with magic, it's a lot, you're working a lot more drinking venues than thinking venues, we talk about at the school. And so being able to have pieces of emotional honesty in the constraints of the script is very difficult in many situations, and it makes it beautiful. And also with this one, what makes it also better than just straight theater is that you get emotional honesty from the participants, because the person, for instance, the letter moment.
That happened.
Moment. This is me during that whole segment. What? Mm-hmm. What? Mm-hmm. How? What? I will admit, I am a very gullible person who, I love magic because I don't care. I don't try to figure it out. I don't care. It's magic. I love it. I love it so much. I have childlike glee at watching magic being performed. And people be like, oh, I bet I could figure that out. It's like, why would you want to figure it out? Like, it's so perfect as it is. So I was so enjoying this show for the mentalism aspects, the sleight of hand aspects, the fact that the camera was right there. So even, I mean, his sleight of hand was so seamless that there wasn't any of the usual like distractions that make sleight of hand possible. It was raw and honest and just laid bare right there. And it was just that good. You don't have to divulge, but did you know how most things were done? Do you feel?
I mean, I was in the same situation that you were, where I wasn't even trying to break it down, which is a very, very rare moment for me.
I would imagine, yeah.
I mean, a lot of what I do is about taking pieces of magic, breaking it down so I can help people reconstruct it. That's what I do at the school. And for this particular piece, it was like, you know what? I don't care.
Yeah.
And part of what makes that work as well with this performance is that the magic is the medium for the performances itself. So ultimately, like, for instance, the brick disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
The magic behind that is fantastic and beautiful and right there in your face and clean. But what's important in the greater sense is the identity of the brick disappearing,
mm-hmm.
that it goes into, that now all of a sudden it's just another brick in the road.
Mm-hmm. And the experience, I think, that you see after it of people finding it and being like, yeah. Oh my God, like it's, and you can tell some of them, it was night. Like they had probably gone just
after the show. They're like,
it's, oh my God, like that. And so just knowing that you're giving that extra moment to your audience that you don't even get to see,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you don't, I mean, in this, for some of the filming, obviously they did, but it was pretty clear when they started the filming for this movie, this filmed version of the show, that he had performed it hundreds of times before.
Well, I think the opening thing said it had been performed like 500 and something times. Yeah.
The brick is one of the ways in which the show expands its reach outside of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like the book is another really good example of that.
The book is such a great piece of that show.
It's not even magic by the theater at all.
Yeah. The book has nothing to do with an illusion. Sorry.
Yeah. Right.
No. The theater doesn't contain the show. And you know, like obviously people bring the show with them and the experience with them as they leave, but there's something about it not just being with you, it's also out there in the world in that brick, a physical mm-hmm. manifestation of the show that you can go and see and verify that like all this was a real thing that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then also with the book, like the someone leaving and not seeing the finale of the show and then coming back the next day where they get to then see the entire show again and the finale is such an incredibly unique experience to be that person. I can't even imagine,
mm-hmm.
but also that book taking the show with it out into the world and then coming back mm-hmm. again is really cool.
Yeah. You know what I was thinking as I was watching it, that the portion about the book and through the end of the show is like, when he asked for somebody to volunteer to leave, you know, nobody raises their hand for a really long time.
Okay.
which is like, of course they wouldn't, right? You don't know what the fuck this dude's asking. And then mm-hmm. slowly a bunch of people raise their hands. He's like, I'm 100% serious. I need somebody to do this.
And only after he tells the story about the ship's logbook, right. too. Like, it's,
And then he does the whole, you know, I had somebody leave last night and I'm going to have them come back up. And I'm like, as soon as I know why he asked people to raise their hands, I would have been like, yes, please pick me. I want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciate that he doesn't do that. He looks for somebody mm-hmm. who's like, I'm going to take a huge, you know, blind leap
mm-hmm.
and say, yes, I will walk out of this show and come back mm-hmm. tomorrow night not mm-hmm. knowing what I missed and not knowing why it's important.
Yep.
It's really, really smart. I obviously, you know, coming as a writer, for me, that's like written really smartly
mm-hmm.
because you want the people that are going to make the choice for that reason, not the mm-hmm. people who are going to make the choice because it's like, oh, cool, I'm in.
Mm-hmm. I think... One of my favorite moments is the show, because we just rewatched the first like half or so before this, we were recording this, was when he says, just when he's like, okay, and now the most terrifying moment for me for every show, did the person from last night come back? Because once you realize what's happening, you think, oh my God, the whole show would just grind to a halt. What would you do? They have the book. The fact that no one ever was like, nah, fuck this guy, I'm gonna keep his book, you know, like, I mean, that's kind of amazing, right?
It's like
that
in York, that's like in, that, yeah, right, yeah. Yeah.
That tourists, you know, people who said they were coming back, you know, anybody, no one got hurt, no one got lost, no one got stuck, like the book always came back the next day. I wonder how often there were it got sent with a proxy, maybe, you know, somebody who was like, I actually can't go, I got sick, or my kid got sick, but you have to go to the show and bring the book back for me. You know, I wonder.
Yeah, and I mean, you can sit there with the logic of, all right, they're not going to let that book leave the theater without that person in the lobby. They're going to be like, okay, I need your cell phone number, and I'm going to call it to make sure it's actually a number, and I need your address, and I need to know
some
all these
things. Some stage manager when they hustle
them
out,
so if something goes wrong, we can get this book back. It's super important.
Yep.
So on one hand, you think about that. You can logic through how they protect themselves. But on the other hand, there still is an element of faith there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe they don't protect themselves. Maybe the whole point is I have to trust that when I put something that is as precious as this clearly is, based on what I'm now seeing that's going on in here, based on what I've seen when this person has come back and read their entry, I have a responsibility to bring this back. And you trust that people are going to carry that forward and you don't protect yourself. You just say, we have to trust ourselves that this will work.
Yeah. I really like that the kind of the overall sort of through line of being seen by a stranger, that he starts out by telling the story of this total stranger just saying to him, well, because you're the ruletista and I thought you should know. Like, you know, I see that, you know, and he doesn't know why. He's like, I don't know why he said that. And that's what basically drove this show. And the idea that toward at the end, when everyone has chosen their piece of paper, for whatever reason they chose it, right? You know, they chose their piece, their ticket, and that then they are being seen by a stranger for what they are, or however they decided to identify that day, that someone is seeing them in that same way, you know. And I just think that that's such a good beginning and end. And he even says, after he names every single person, he says, and as you all know, I'm the ruletista. Yeah. And it's such a, like, you know, that man saw me, and so now I see all of you, you know. And it's just so cool.
It's the whole, like, the chambers of the revolver coming back around full circle to an empty chamber that was the first, you know, where he started the show. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, maybe the biggest illusion of all was the illusion of self or the illusion of identity, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of a jokey or hokey thing to say, but I really kind of feel like playing with people's identities is risky, and it paid off so incredibly well.
And I mean, as you said, I mean, playing with people's identity, the letter routine is talking just about that. I mean, it is literally talking about playing with people's identity. And you know, what's interesting is also, instead of learning people's names, like as he's choosing people, he's calling them by these identities, and it's almost more intimate that way, if that makes sense. So when he calls on the mirror, now all of a sudden there's more at stake because of that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think, you know, if I call you Will, now there's a lot of, because I've known you for a long time, there's a lot that goes into that. But if I don't know you at all and I call you Will, it's really just a label. Mirror is more than a label because it tells me something deeper about you. So I'm not calling you just this label that society has provided. I'm providing an identification that you've given yourself that now tells me something deeper about you and provides a deeper connection. I think that's kind of what I saw in that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think too, I love that there's no explanation to people when they're walking in. It's just, take one.
Yep.
Like, what? Just whichever one you want, take one. And he does at one point say, a lot of you probably pick joke answers, you know, and ninja, that's and ninja or pirate or whatever. And that's fine. You know, that's great. But I would ask you to sit down, you know. And so he doesn't do the final, I mean, for lack of a better term, mentalism trick with the people who picked joke answers, which I find very interesting.
Yeah,
it's only the people who chose something about themselves that they thought was real, and I think that really speaks a lot to why he's doing what he's doing as well.
Right. Well, that also gives it meaning. I mean, that also gives it just straight up meaning, because as you said, if he just named everybody in the audience, that would be a piece of mentalism. Mm-hmm. But now all of a sudden there is identity and there is relationship. Mm-hmm. And it creates a web of relationship. This is something that I lecture on at Magic School, that there's five members, there's five possible people in a piece of magic. There's five possible actors in it, or, you know, people that can be interacted with. There's the magician, there's the magic itself, there is the audience, there are the props, and there is anybody who is up on stage. So the audience and the person up on stage are two kind of different people. Mm-hmm. And each of those five things have a relationship to one another. All these things are usually in a piece of magic. So now all of a sudden, this magic, you know, there's a relationship between the person and the magic. Every single person is an audience or is a participant, or at least half of them are, because the people who stay standing up are now participants as opposed to audience members. So now there's an additional weave of the layer there, and it's all really great, you know, relationship building. I was watching it, and I'm like, yes, theater.
I read an interview with Derek Delgadio where they asked him, with the letter bit, the letter illusion trick, whatever, who is your favorite, what was your favorite moment with the person reading the letter? And he said there was a man who he handed him the letter, and it said, father. And he said, do you have a father? And the man said, I don't. And so he opens the letter and he's reading it, and he starts to cry, and he's like, you know, it's from my father-in-law. And then he corrects himself and he says, it's from my father. Oh. And just that, oh my God, just that moment of like, oh no. Like, you just helped me realize something about my own heart that I didn't even understand. Like, just, and that just blew me away. I it's one of those things where you just instantly are like, what I love about magic is I immediately want to know how it was done, and I immediately never want to know how it was done, because I don't ever want to know, but I want to think about, oh my God, like, I couldn't even imagine. Like, it's just so incredible that they had all those letters.
I feel like when there's something mechanical happening, an engineer part of my brain is like, I wonder what the gimmick is there, or I wonder how it's physically happening there, right? Yeah. But when it's something that's like the card dealing and tricks he's doing, like, there's two things I could watch just hours and hours of videos of on YouTube. And that's like card tricks like that, and like counting dealing, and break dancing. Like, just like those two things. It's just like they're physical things that I'll never have the dexterity to be able to pull off, that require you know, thousands of hours of effort to be able to do flawlessly. And I could just watch them and appreciate them for an unlimited amount of time. And I don't care how they're done necessarily, because that's not what's enjoyable to me. What's enjoyable to me, it's like watching ballet. It's watching these people do these complicated things in a way that makes it seem effortless.
So, Will, I have a challenge for you as a magician.
Yeah.
I would like you to come up with a card trick that you can perform while break dancing. Ooh, just for Nick. So Nick,
obviously we know you can break dance because you're a magician. So.
Yes.
Right. It's so funny. So are you, question Will, are you able to do a double hand fan, and do you have a headshot of yourself with the double hand fan of cards?
My headshot has a single hand fan.
Very good.
When I was 20 years old, it's amazing. One of those rite of passages. It's on.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, I have a very serious acting headshot where I'm looking very seriously at the camera.
That's a video Easter egg for folks.
I was gonna say, yes, for listeners.
Patreon.
It was a dope fan.
Subpar double fan.
See, I have the comedy headshot, and that is the obligatory. I'm laughing as if the photographer had just said something really funny. That's you know, everybody.
You can see how funny I am because I laugh at jokes.
I have a sense of humor. Yeah, right.
Oh my gosh! Yeah,
Does anybody have a favorite moment that really really stuck with you? I mean, we've talked about some of them, but I wanted to know if there was a.
Yeah, I think my favorite. Honestly, my favorite moment was when he is talking about how he's talking about the dog and the wolf, and he's doing all the card manipulation. He's talking about how these guys are always going to want more. No matter what you give them, they're going to want a better hand, no matter what you do. So you have to be careful because they're always going to accuse you of cheating, you know, and you can't get mad about that. You have to just get over it now. And he deals out and he's just showing you, he's just doing the king, and he has the king of spades on top, and he's showing you how he can deal with the king of spades on top. And then he flips it over and he shows you how it's just seamless. And there's still the king of spades. And then there's all four kings. And then there's all four aces. And you didn't even know it doesn't even look like he was doing anything. And they're just boom, 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 boom. The aces, the queens, the kings, all of it's there. You know, if you want all the spades, and he deals out all the spades blindfolded. That I used to play cards, and I loved doing fancy dealing tricks when I played competitive bridge. And so like that to me, I was just like, yee! Like, I love cards. Like, it was just so good. There were other more emotional moments, but for me, that was the most like joyful, gleeful moment, I think, of the special.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think for me, the penultimate trick when he was doing the piece of mentalism and like being able to see the people's reactions from hundreds of shows that they filmed on it. Mm-hmm. And like, for instance, when he took and the occasional, like his awareness of tension and release in the theater, build moment, and then knowing exactly where to do it. And that comes from doing 500 plus shows.
Yes.
Like, for instance, when he hit nobody.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden, right. It's suddenly like a baseball bat, and there's an entire, it reminds me of, I think, what was it? It was it the Hemingway, the 6-word story?
Yes. Baby shoes for sale, baby never worn.
Yeah. Baby shoes for sale, never worn. And that entire like roller coaster of emotion with just 6 words. And there's the same sort of thing going on with just one.
Yeah,
because the silence is part of the acting, and it's part of the moment, and it's an awareness about what he's doing. And so being able to see something masterful in that way is really enjoyable for me on the magician side of it, because I teach a lot of the theater of magic at the school. So that would be my moment.
Yeah. Next, Tim.
I feel like, I mean, I'm so divided, because you know, the theater brain part of me is when he's identifying the audience members and acknowledging their identity with the cards is such an emotional part of the show, over and over and over. But I do really, really enjoy what he was doing with the cards. But I think if I was going to pin it down to a specific moment within a trick, it is finding out later after the fact that people he's acknowledging in the audience are some people that he knows.
Oh yeah.
Or I can't remember who the magician was, but another.
Oh yeah. No, go ahead.
Yeah. Oh no. There was some magician of note in the audience for one of his shows. Was David Blaine?
I'm pretty sure.
And instead of greeting him by the card fully, he says he acknowledges him as like brother, like my brother, in magic or whatever. Mm-hmm. And just like, it seemed like even though he was kind of going outside the lines of what he had done, he still got it right.
Yep.
And he still was able to like give a little like wink and an elbow to another magician. And they shared a moment there that was more personal than even some of the other things that had happened. And I didn't even know that was happening when I saw it. It was something I found out later when I was reading about the show. And I really liked that.
Mm-hmm. Sam, what about you?
For me, it's honestly during the same trick, but it's because it's a payoff when his mom's in the audience.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's a payoff to that story from earlier. Just that moment of realism. That he and vulnerability that he is willing to show, which makes it possible for the audience. And it's because of that, you see why it makes it possible for the audience to show that vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Because you really, as a performer, you have to know that you're not going to be able to get the audience to show vulnerability to you unless you are willing to show that to them. Mm-hmm. It is very much of a give and take experience. So that was a really nice moment that I enjoyed a lot.
My favorite part of that entire piece of I don't know what to call it, experience, right, moment, was the people that you would see that, because he was just going down the line, right? So you would know when it was going to be your turn. And it wasn't like he had an order he was doing them in. He was just going down the line of the rows for a lot of it. And so he would look at somebody and just you would see the naked expectation and hope and almost a little bit of fear on their face that he was going to get theirs wrong.
Yeah.
And then when he would say it, and the way that they would look both relieved and shocked and awed and like just joyful at it too. There was just so many complicated emotions. All when there are people who look at, they were vibrating from just being like, and like taking shaking breaths, and then he would say, they were going to pass out. Like, it was just amazing.
You could see the person next.
Yeah.
Too. Like, he'd be addressing one person, you could see the next person, or even a person two people over, start to have like a moment where they're like, oh fuck, like it's coming up to me. You could see the tension building in them.
Just beautiful.
All right. Mm-hmm. So I want to, if there's any final thoughts that we have on In and of Itself before we move on, we have five questions, but I have another thing that I'm going to ask Will about before we get to five questions that I didn't tell him or y'all about, but exciting. I thought of it while we were talking. So
final thoughts on the show.
Any final thoughts that you want to share with our listeners, other than you should really watch this, but is there anything else that really stuck with you?
I could do with more of this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's singular and it's unique, and I don't want this exact thing, though it is very rewatchable. I would love to see more, not even necessarily magic, but more theater experiences recorded so that I can enjoy them at home, because I can't get to off-Broadway shows, especially not during a pandemic, but even outside of the pandemic, really. I could do with more of this. I could do with more experimental theater, provocative experimental theater being mainstreamed through streaming services. I love that. More, please.
I would say if you loved this, you should absolutely watch all three of Bo Burnham's specials.
Oh yeah,
which are they are booked as comedy specials. He calls them one man shows, and that's what they are. And I would say they are increasingly fraught in a way with emotion and self discovery and introspection, but they are hilarious. And it is to comedy what this is to magic, in that way that it is deeply personal, raw, and an experience that will leave you feeling, you'll be thinking about it for days.
Yeah.
And so that's what this did for me, is something that most entertainment can't do. I couldn't shake it. Couldn't shake it for days. I just kept my mind just kept coming back to it and turning it over in my mind and feeling the feelings all over again.
I guess the thing that I would ask the people who are listening, specifically to the theatrically minded, so people who do put on performances and one-man shows and things of that nature, would be to, after you've watched this, also think about how many additional people behind the scenes collaborated on this as well. Because something of this magnitude and scope is not just a single vision. Now, I mean, Derek did huge amounts of work on it, and he does the performance in that, but there's also a director, and there's lighting designers, and there's people that you bounce back and forth on. And then there are his mentors and all the magicians that he's interacted with, and where did he get his inspiration from? So, you know, what I would ask people who do theater themselves is not only think, oh, this is just one person who did this in a self-contained box without being in part of community, reaching out and, you know, putting those feelers out, create community, make the art in group, and you can have your idea and your vision, but, you know, don't try and lift the world on your own shoulders by yourself. Get a team to do it.
Yeah.
My big thoughts there.
He is part of a performance art collective called A. Bandit. So that's very much, there was a lot of people in this. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'll piggyback on what Nick said. I think one of the things that modern theater lacks. And we actually talked about this in a episode with Wendy not so terribly long ago, is that they don't film theater except in very special circumstances. You're very lucky to get something like Hamilton on Disney Plus. Mm-hmm. The number of musicals that have come and gone with no opportunity to see the performance by the original cast because they didn't create an archive. The fact that this exists, this archive exists of this performance, that they chose to do things like pull in moments from several performances rather than just focus on a single mm-hmm. performance to show us how this show is different, experienced differently with different people, is something that I would love to see a lot more of and I think is lacking in theater. So to get to the question that none of us knew I was going to ask, Will... Those of us, yeah. those of you listening may or may not be aware, was on Fool Me with Penn and Teller. And I just
yes.
wondered...
Or Fool Us, yes.
Fool Us with Penn and Teller, excuse me. And I was wondering if you had a story or something you'd like to share from that experience before we move on to five questions. And I didn't give you a chance to prepare for it, so I'm letting you think a little bit by vamping for a moment.
We were at home and we were watching a boy make good.
Yeah, we were like, oh, it's Will, look at him.
I know him.
Yeah.
I've seen him do magic.
Mm-hmm. And this actually is very good timing because I kid you not, this last Monday, so what, 2 days ago, mm-hmm. I was on another virtual podcast specifically talking about Penn and Teller's Fool Us.
Like wow.
I was a poor magician. So, you know, that out of nowhere, after a couple of years, suddenly it's like, Will. Everybody's like, Will, tell me about Penn and Teller's Fool Us.
Will on Fool Us, so hot right now.
Yeah, it's so hot. Which, yet again, so like a week ago, I watched that for the first, I showed my girlfriend that for the first time, Zoolander, like about the world is just contracting.
We're just hitting all the
buttons. So let's see.
This is my mentalism.
Yeah, an experience about Fool Us. All right. The a part of the Fool Us experience that the magician or the entertainers have to go through that you don't really recognize or realize watching it is the process of waiting the day off. So, you know, I had already spent about 2 years going through different pieces of material to come up with this. And I worked with the producers and we talked and decided what worked film-wise versus close-up. And yet again, we're talking about team, you know, doing this. And so it comes mm-hmm. the day of, and you get there at 8 in the morning, Penn and Teller's Theater, you know, you have a little bit of a rehearsal, and then you are tucked away in the basement with 8 other performers, because they film about 8 of them. And it's 8 o'clock in the morning, and the actual filming itself doesn't really start until, like, 4 or 5 o'clock.
Oh my gosh.
Oh boy.
Because it just takes that much time and everybody needs to have a little bit of time to mm-hmm. go through, and then there's hair and makeup and you're mm-hmm. dealing with a lot of people, and then the people have to come in and you need to be able to make sure that you're there plenty ahead of time. And oh wait, there's the sound checks and there's the light checks.
Yep.
Make sure that everything, do a run through, work on it with the tech crew. And then that's
time for lunch.
And that's all the active part.
Yeah.
And then what happens is you're down there and the 8 magicians, and they call the first magician up, and they leave the waiting room, this green room in the basement, and they leave, and then they never return again. They're just gone.
Oh my gosh. Then, what?
Yeah.
What number were you?
I was like 7. So I watched 6 people enter into the abyss. And from where you are, it's underneath the stage, because that's where the green room is. And so while that's going on, you can, you know, hear the audience.
Yeah.
There's like, you know, I'm not 100% certain what their capacity is, but it's a huge showroom.
Thousands and thousands, yeah.
And so when they're applauding and roaring, they actually kind of, sometimes on TV, actually turn it down.
Oh, wow.
Press it. Like, for instance, when I was on Fool Us and when I went up there, I used a little trick that my magic mentor taught me to double the amount of applause that you receive when you come on stage the first time. The ability to double the amount of applause you get without doing a single thing. And so I went forward and I did this. I used this principle. And so I went up there and I applaud, and it was like 30 seconds on stage of just applause from people. And it, what happened is that, you know, applaud, 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 and then it kind of started dying down. And then it continued to dip, and then it went back up again. Hey! And, you know, the second time. That's part of what that principle is.
Yeah.
It just kept on going. And then the moment, and I desperately, this was the one thing that I was disappointed about with the real thing that I was disappointed on, is that during the bust moment, the first thing that Penn said to me, he's like, wow, you know, Will, first of all, you know, fantastic. You're from Vegas. I'm guessing you're from Vegas. And I'm like, oh, yeah. And it's like, yeah, you have a lot of fans out there, I can tell. And then they didn't put that in the final cut.
Oh,
that's the sound clip. That's right? The sound clip that I want. You know,
yeah.
You have a lot of fans out there. Penn Jillette.
Yeah.
I might still put it. I might start putting that in my in my promo reel. But it's
he can't say he didn't say it. Moment. He can't say it's a lie.
Well, but what would be great is on my promo clip is, you know, thing of Penn Jillette. Oh, you got a lot of fans out there.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, please.
Oh, what might be just as good as we were more disturbed by your performance than Allison was.
Yeah, that was great. I really loved it. Seemed like they were giving you code phrases to let you know they knew what you'd done when they talked to you.
Without
saying it.
So. An additional just little bit. This is with that as well. I had done something that I thought I was being really, really clever and sneaky about. But I was like, oh, look at this. I'm gonna do this really sneaky thing, and it's going to give me a 50-50 shot.
Yeah.
Very worse, which is a lot better than a lot of people did. So I do this, I come up with this idea and I go through it and I'm like, it works out and it gives me a 50-50 chance going into this. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, look at how sneaky I am. And I had these plans put together in case if they started going down the wrong path.
Yeah.
And what happened is in the moment, the adrenaline is running so high and fantastic that what ended up happening is, at least this is my observation of it, is that they were giving me code for the wrong thing.
Oh.
But I was so caught up in that moment that I didn't react to it at all.
Uh-huh.
And then I think there was a moment of realization of, wait, we're on the wrong path, and I switched it over to the correct path last second.
So
I was just going along and talking, and I'm sitting there nodding. And then this is my thoughts on it. They might not be true whatsoever. And even if it is true, I don't really feel bad about it, because I was being like, oh, look at me, I'm being so sneaky, look at this. And they just straight up beat me at my own fucking thing.
Like, which is technically the show.
But that's another layer deeper in the Penn and Teller fool us. Like, so there's the game on the front of creating this great magic show and this wonderful experience. And now there's a little back and forth. But now there's layers upon layers where the magicians are kind of trying to be one step ahead and tricking each other isn't even able to be perceived properly.
Yeah.
Because, you know, some of the stuff I realized when I was there, and afterwards I was kicking myself. I'm like,
oh man,
damn it.
Yeah. I remember my dad texted me, and he was like, I'm watching the show, and it's like, these magicians, they're not even telling them how they did it. They're just assuming, they're just like taking the defeat. I'm like, dad, they're telling them how they did it. You just don't know. And he's okay.
Definitely, there was code, and Yeah, and they beat me at my own game, and I didn't even realize it until I was done. And I'm like, oh,
those are great stories. Those are great stories.
Thank you for those stories. Okay, yeah. We're going to move on to five questions. Anybody who's on our show the first time gets five questions. Will has been informed of these five questions ahead of time. I am going to let you know, before we start, we have identified one listener. You have received an email. You must turn off the podcast now and write down what you believe Will's answers will be to these questions, and you'll find out the answers to the question on next week's podcast. So that's the Easter egg we have on this week's podcast. Nick, why don't you start us off with question number one?
What conspiracy theory do you find the most interesting or intriguing? It doesn't have to be something you believe, but...
Something that just boggles my mind to no extent is the flat earth conspiracy. It boggles my mind so much. And part of it for me, I guess, is because I've flown over to China from LA on a place where flat earthers don't believe exists.
Yeah.
It's like, no, China's over on the one side. And so it just kind of boggles my mind. But then there's like the little jokey part of my mind as well, which goes, well, yeah, but Will, that was like a 24-hour flight, and you slept in the middle of it. So they like put gas in the thing.
You don't know.
Sleep, and then flew really fast around the other side.
All the airlines are in on it. Oh my God. Yeah.
Oh, they have to be
and
on
so
it.
There's a little bit of that, which is like, oh my God, but not in any serious moment.
Yeah.
Okay. Question number two, what is your perfect 2-week vacation? Money is no object, but physics is a limiting factor.
Yeah. I mean, I would absolutely love to do like a tour of Europe and Ireland and England and Germany, and being able to just like, get my backpack like I used to do with the Renaissance Festival and fucking kick it and all, like do some performing and busking as well, but stay
in
nice places too. Like, so I don't have to really worry about being homeless, but if I had the option to be homeless, absolutely. I'd be homeless for a little bit. To say, well,
you're just busking for pleasure. You're not busking to find a place to sleep. It's just pleasure busking.
Yeah. it's for fun at that point. And then now all of a sudden I'm being able to travel around Europe and be able to see that. And now there's no obligations or worries or the weights of the world. It's like, all right, it's 2 weeks. I don't really exist to anybody else. I'm going to go fucking explore and wander.
Yeah. That's dream.
And come across weird little nook and crannies.
Yeah. That street magician just hopped on a private jet.
That would be. Yeah.
All right. Question three. What is a movie or a book that changed your life and why?
I would absolutely say like the first book that like seriously changed my life was Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, well, I can forgive you. I was upset it was a book, but whatever. It's a great book.
Good answer.
It's probably the book that I've read the second most often. But I came across it before the later one, which was Dune. I've read Dune more than I've read Hitchhiker's Guide. But I was in high school, and I was just starting to kind of get my identity put together and figuring out all these things. And I was in beginning theater, and then I came across Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and the entire genre of British humor, and I'm like, yes, this is revolutionary. This is ridiculous and out here. And then, like, you know, big part, like, for instance, like going all the way to my Renaissance Festival performance when I was playing, you know, my mime, like that dead mime joke is absolutely in that kind of like world of Hitchhiker Guide to the Galaxy humor. And so, and then that suddenly that leads to me being, you know, actually enjoyed as an entertainer at the Renaissance Festival and that entire weird madness thing. And then my job teaching at a school, and now I work for David fucking Copperfield. And it's all because I read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy in high school, and I decided I wanted to be a weirdo because of it.
Thank you, Douglas Adams.
That's a great fucking answer, and Douglas Adams would love that
answer.
Do
you know where your towel is?
Oh yeah. Now we're friends on Facebook. So if you actually go through quite a few of my travel photos while I'm getting ready to go to or from places, like I take my final photo before I head out to a place, I literally have my towel with me.
I've seen it. Yeah. I've seen it.
Awesome. Incredibly applicable. Because, like, yeah, when I was traveling back and forth from New York, I would use the towel and you would wrap it around your head to sleep or use it as a pillow. It was fucking useful. Mm-hmm. It was great.
They are very handy.
There's a novel that came out just a few years ago called Space Opera by Catherine Valente, which is like a spiritual successor to Hitchhiker's Guide. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so good. It's basically like space Eurovision.
Yeah.
And it's comedy. It's really, if you like Hitchhiker's Guide, I kind of recommend that, folks. So question four is, what's the geekiest thing you've ever said or done?
Oh God!
I know it's going to be hard because you're a professional magician.
Right, I'm a professional magician. That's pretty far out there. It's just a thing between almost me and my girlfriend more than anything else. But when the movie House with Clocks in the Walls came out with Jack Black in it, and he's like, this isn't a robe, it's a kimono. Yeah. And I have said that more often than I would like to admit, and I consider it extra geeky because it's like a real fucking obscure reference that only a couple people would get, and it's 100% in character for me.
I know very few people who saw that movie. I did see that movie. But I know very few other people who saw that movie. So
it's fantastic. It's one of my favorites. I'm like Jack Black's character in it. A part of me hates it, but I'm like, yes. So I guess that's me. This is what the world sees me as, and I have to just come to terms with that. And embrace it. And
it's a good shot now.
Oh, it's great. It's totally worth the watch.
All right, okay, question number five. The simplest question: what's your favorite hangover cure?
Gosh, I mean, sleeping an additional 8 hours, I would say.
Right.
You know, I try real hard not to get hangovers. I mean, the first time I got a real hangover was my freshman year of college, and it was the celebration that we got finished our first year. And then I went out drinking totally legally with my roommate, and he got me drunk to the point where I'm certain that I'm lucky that I was alive, because I have a just vomiting. So ever since that first moment, it's like, all right, let's do preventative care instead. Let's not, because I had to move out of my dormitory by myself the next day with the worst hangover.
Oh, it only takes a couple times of forking up literally everything that you've ever had exist inside your body cellularly that really you understand that you have to not drink that much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was hungover for like a solid 24 hours after that night.
Until
the next day, I was miserable and vomiting, and I had to move all my shit up like three flights of stairs with no elevator because New York.
Oh, dorms.
That will, for most people, that will get you off being hungover. Great. Well, Will, thanks so much for joining us. It was so great to have you here and have your insight on this movie. And it was great to see you. We haven't seen you in a while. Will's off in Las Vegas being a bigwig and teaching people how to be magic.
You know, if you guys ever head out to Vegas, head out to Fremont Street. You can see me doing my show out there once the world becomes sane to go out about. And again, I'll be probably heading back out there and doing my show again.
Exciting.
Look for Will on Fremont Street in Las Vegas. We've been Geeks Without God. If you enjoyed our show, of course, you can support us on Patreon. And then you could watch the amazing video in which you can watch Will do a double fan. Wow. So, that's he just did it again. He just did it again. But you missed it because you're not a Patreon supporter. You also, of course, could send us 5 questions because we still are pretty short on those. We've been getting some into the hopper, but we could use more. We really appreciate it. We are going to be back next week with another episode, everybody. So good night, everybody. Goodbye. We're done. Bye.
Bye.
The person who was supposed to leave stayed, didn't they? They stayed and ruined this fucking episode for everybody else.
We're geeks, we're geeks, we're geeks without God. We're geeks, we're geeks, we're geeks without God. We don't recognize moral authority. We don't accept divine superiority. We're geeks, geeks without God.
Until next time, you can find us blogging at geekswithoutgod.com. You can follow us on Twitter at geekswithoutgod, and you can even like us on Facebook.
We're geeks, we're geeks, we're geeks without God. We're geeks, we're geeks, we're geeks without God. We're geeks, geeks without God.
If you are there for 5 years and then you leave for a year because, say, your dad's dying of cancer or some shit like that, and then you come back, you start over at one.